afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording, to another episode, to another conversation. This one's going to be very, very interesting. I've got with me my guest of honor, Yuka Nakasone. Yuka, you joined me from where? From Barcelona, right? I'm assuming. Is that where you are?
Yes.
It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon here. So what is it, like 10 o'clock at night for you?
Yeah, it's 10, but in Spain, 10 o'clock at night is not so late. So it's okay.
Not so late.
And thank you very much for inviting.
Yeah, no problem. And we've been trying to make this happen for a long time, Yuka, right? We finally made it happen. That's good. Yes. We've attempted it before. We sort of ran into some scheduling issues and some other small issues here and there. But now we finally made it happen. That's all that matters.
Great.
You know, from my perspective, when I got into this idea of having a conversation with you, I wanted to understand two few things. One is I would love to understand your personal journey, because I read a lot about you and what you did in your career, where you are right now. And it's pretty interesting to hear your personal journey for our audience. Our audience are always interested in, you know, those personal, I want to say, chapters in our lives and how we got here. And the audience always asks me and tell me, like, look, can we get a little bit more into the human side aspect of it from ourselves, right? So the career aspect, everybody has that, and, you know, to various degrees of, I would call, success, whatever you define success nowadays. Mm. It's not about money. I generally think it's about, are you happy where you are in life? So I know, you know, from back in the days when you worked at CLS Communication, and I worked at CLS Communication, I remember. Mm. And I remember that in part of your journey. For those who don't know you, let's start with this one. For those who don't know you, never met you before, if you don't mind, we do ask the story question. That's what we get started with. What is your personal story? What's your journey? How did you get here?
So to make a very long story pretty short, because I'm not young, as you can see, I just bumped into localization. I didn't intend to be a translator either, even if I have a degree in language. And when I was in the university, when I was asked what I wanted to do in the future, I knew what I didn't want to do. I don't want to do translator, you know, because blah. But I went to the United States to learn English, quitting my career where I started working in, let's say, real estate projects, big money, making buildings or resort or these things, that I started to work in Spain after the university. I quit and I went back to Japan, and I met an American girl there as a host family in Japan. And she was by chance from Boston. When he went back to Boston, I said to myself, why not going to Boston? Because I lived in Madrid in Spain after the university, but I am a Japanese. So that means that everything American is kind of dream. And the English I was taught was American English. So I just casually went to learn English to a summer school in Boston. And back then, in the 90s, when you need a job, you needed to go through a Sunday edition of a big, big newspaper, you know, like listing and posting. I don't know if you remember. And we had to
actually do the looking through the paper for a job. You're right.
Yeah. And cut and, you know, all that kind of stuff. One day, I was not looking for a job, but Angela was, because she just arrived from Japan and she needed a job. And it was in Boston. So she was looking for a teaching job, but she came with a small clip like this, just small, like very small, saying, maybe you can apply for this. This looks interesting. And it was a job posting for Japanese localization specialist by International Communications. And I just casually applied and I was invited for an interview and I just got the job. So that's how I met localization. It was by chance, and they sponsored the H-1B visa in the States. So I started my localization career there in Boston, Massachusetts, dealing with, back then we had a big, big digital corporate, you know, so we did big projects. So that's how I started to do the localization.
What was the name of the company you started with, Yuka, remind?
International communications, and it was bought by Lionbridge. So if I
Oh,
were
it's not
to,
better.
that's why maybe our career crossed or not crossed, I don't know. But
Yeah.
if I go to the headquarters,
Oh,
I still see my ex-colleagues' faces, and
you do.
my boss was Didier Lan,
Okay.
the vendor director for a long, 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 long time, and I traveled with him to Japan and all that kind of stuff. So that's how I started my career.
And what got you to CLS? How did you get to CLS?
This, I don't know if I worked at
You did
CLS.
not work directly with CLS. You worked with Lionbridge.
Yes. And no, I didn't, because before International Communications was bought by Lionbridge, I moved to Barcelona, quitting the job.
Okay.
And I wanted to divorce with localization, because I was very successful, and there's a promised position, there's a promised salary, blah blah blah, but I was burned out, so I wanted to get divorced. I came to Barcelona with where I already had my friends, friends, and I was already speaking Spanish, so there's no problem. And I started to work in other office jobs, but I don't know if you know it or not, Spanish salary is kind of not great, let's put it in this way, even if you speak five languages. So it was a struggle for me to make the end meet. And then, as I was doing big jobs and working with Japanese vendors from the States with Japan, one of the vendors back then, the president came to see me in Spain. Hey, I have 5 days of vacation. Can I come to see? So I said, why not? I'm here for, 1 year of sabbatical. I'm not doing anything. And he came, and he convinced me to go back to localization, and but working for SLV. So the pyramidal structure of
Yep.
localization, right? MLV, MLV, SLV, freelance. And I came from MMLV to freelance. So that's how I got the perspective of MLV and then freelance. And then I created my small SLV here. And then I went to the client side, because one of my friends here in Barcelona got 4 million euros investment from Japan. It was a marketing technology company. And he hired me because he knew me very well. And he invited me to do localization, because I figured out that there's no good internationalization or localization was done without anybody. So I proposed to take care of that. And I started to work with them. So that's how I went into the client side. And after that, I worked for Intento a little bit. And then I went to my, I don't know how to put it, client side, but not doing only localization, but helping the companies to go really global, taking care of other things like marketing, sales, and understanding how to run business. And I did export import. I'm consulting SMBs. That's how I got here today. And because I do this, and my character is connector, natural connector, connecting people, I
Yeah.
can't help not connecting. If I
Yeah,
talk to you and I hear something interesting and some faces pop up in my mind saying maybe they need to talk, I just cannot help connecting these people. So I got a chance to work with a company called Global Chamber, which is a chamber of commerce, but very unique one. We have 600 cities in the world connecting people, and I'm taking care of the Spanish development. I'm the executive director of the Global Chamber, Barcelona, Madrid, Valencia, and Malaga, and I'm expanding little by little.
Do you have any connections here in Canada with the global? Do you have any connections in Canada for the global change for the global change?
And the company I'm consulting is a Canadian company as well, so I have some tie with Canada. And I went to Gala Montreal last year,
I
so
missed you there.
I
I was there, but I
yeah
probably.
probably we missed each other. And I saw Global Chamber people over there as well, and not just localization people, but I was seeing business people in Montreal. And of course, I have some people in Toronto and Vancouver. So yeah, I have some good contacts in Canada.
If you want to add me to that list, I'd be happy to help you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much. Are you in
Now,
Toronto?
so yeah, I am in Toronto actually. So yes, I do want to talk a little bit about, you were born in Japan, you speak five languages. One individual would say, well, it's a natural progression into the localization industry, but you've resisted it though. You
Yeah,
said,
I
I don't
did.
want this, and then you keep coming back into it.
Yeah.
What is it about the industry that, A, I couldn't leave you alone? It has sort of brought you back in.
That's an interesting question because I resisted, yes. But I guess, I mean, localization or language industry or translation industry, I don't know how to cut, but this industry we have is a people business. Everything is based on relationships. This is how I perceive. And we are small industry, so we know each other pretty well. And I think we help each other a lot. We compete sometimes, but beyond the competition, we really help each other. And this is what I am always attracted back into the industry. And of course, my knowledge about localization from different angles. And I did some technology. I don't know how to call it because I was working with Dave Ruan from the very early stage of Process Innovation Challenge. And I worked with him for about 5 years. So I went into the technology side of localization. And if you know technology, processes, and people, you can do localization pretty well, right? And that's how I can make people who don't know localization convinced to do localization, or I can help them efficiently, effectively. That's how I always go back, you know, because if I help them to internationalize, maybe localization is not the first step. But of course it comes, you know.
You've said something very interesting that you've seen the industry from the 90s all the way to what it is right now. And you also worked on various aspects of various angles, you called it in the language industry. However, if somebody like even for me who started, not in the 90s, but early 2000, I just jumped into the industry by complete accident. As you did yourself, I am a technologist by background and somehow I found my way into the localization industry. The industry back then, looking where it is right now, it was very different to what it is right now. And anybody you ask, it will tell you that. What is the thing that most surprised you the most, I guess I would say, when you compare the world of today to what it was back then?
Resilience, because we always had to run with the client, and even if you're on the client side, people who don't understand localization usually doesn't give a lot of attention to the localization. So we need to evangelize first, and then we need to convince to get budget and fight. Even on the client side, we always had to fight. We need to be resilient. And I always surprise how we reinvented ourselves every single time, because back then in 90s, I was international at international communications. We are creating a tool which is one of the roots of the translation workspace at Lionbridge. You know, so we created the CAD tool with
Ended up at the transition workspace. Do you
And we created with a high school dropout genius developer sitting with
high school
the language
dropout
group.
genius. I love that.
Yeah, and he was very, very young. He was teenager, and he was sitting with the language group, and hearing the requests and requirements. And he was kind of developing coding and creating this tool. And after that, we went into machine translation journey. And I was already aware that the big company in Redmond, with which I worked a lot, was already starting to create the machine translation army in the 90s. And I saw the development, and every single time It came to the, industry. We needed to reinvent. There's some resistance, but we adapted CAT tool, TMS, then machine translation, and then now LLM. And it seems like we always know how to adapt ourselves.
And move around the technology and figure out what to do with the next technology phase, right? So the industry is pretty survivable this way. And for those out there who are listening to this and they're thinking, with all the changes that are coming at us as an industry, and you're thinking that the world is going to be the end of the world for the localization industry. Listening to
No.
this conversation right now with Yuka Nakasone tells me that that's far from the truth, because obviously we've seen so many technologies that came along and we've adapted, we've evolved, we've absorbed these technologies, we've used them, we've applied them. And, to be honest and to be frank with everybody, in some cases, in a lot of cases, we did not take on these technology with open heart. We've taken them on pretty much, begrudgingly, meaning that we were forced to take it on and we had to take it on because the boss said so in some cases, or because the customer forced us to in a lot of other cases. So, again, this is a testimony to how this industry has evolved over time. Thank you, Yuka, for taking us down the memory lane. And I was so impressed with the story of the translation workspace for language, how young person, drop out from high school, and we have many of those examples throughout history. It doesn't mean, a high school dropout is necessarily a bad thing. Many of the billionaires that we've got around the world today are high school dropouts. So, if that's it, if that's a testimony to it, of accomplishment, that should be one. In fact, I interviewed somebody on the podcast here about a few, what is it, a month ago now? A few weeks ago. High school stopped going to high school, stopped going to university at that's 18 years old, stopped all of that. He got his first VC money, millions of dollars, and he started his own company. And now he's teaching others how to get VC money at 18 years old. And, at 18 years old, for me, I mean, I lived in a different life, but completely different than what this individual is doing. We live in a world where there's a plethora. There's a plenty of opportunities. There's plenty of opportunities to make things happen. Back in, early on humanity, to make something happen, we actually has to go to the fields, cut the bricks, build a house. Now we don't have to do things with our own hands. Robots can do the work. Technology can help us. We're focusing on the use of our brains now. It's much easier to develop. It's much easier to adapt. Now, for you, Yuka, you own a company, and correct me if I'm wrong, because the research says you own, could be wrong, I don't know, a global bridge. That's your own organization. And so what was the moment you said, okay, I know you were always like, you wanted to do something on your own and you went to localization, not by choice, but you could. If somebody pulled you in, you decided to stop working for someone else and create something called a Global Bridge, and probably tell us what Global Bridge is.
The real reason why I created this company was to have distance between myself, personal self, and business, because I'm Japanese expat in Spain, and I started to work with big projects like Expo, Spanish Pavilion in Japan, blah blah blah. I started to create some money and called attention of tax authorities. So the tax advisor said the best way to protect myself is create a company, even if I am not that big, to justify the cost to have a company. So that's the reason why I have it. But I love it because even for translation, if I want to work with a client which has a procurement department, they usually don't get any freelancers. So that's how I operate. It's a totally remote digital company from the beginning. I created that company in 2000, between 2005 and 6. So it's been 20 years, but I decided not to hire anybody. And it's my company. By project, I hire people.
If you have
And
a project and you need people, you hire people.
if it's a localization project, I need maybe localization engineer, internationalization engineer, translators, editors, copywriters, whoever you call it, right? And I create the team and do the job. If it's a import export, other set of people. So that's how I operate.
So it's in the localization.
Yes. a part of the activity is I still get some localization project from the past.
Okay.
Yes, it covers, but I do interpretation as well, and I pick and choose what I'm interested in. I usually do very high-end business interpretation where they really need consecutive interpreter, not just translator who is translating word by word to
Correct.
summarize and
That's very
guide.
complex. A job, a consecutive or simultaneous interpretation. That's pretty interesting and difficult job to do sometimes.
Yeah, and I do only Japanese and English here in Spain because there's no many Japanese people speaking high-end business English here. So I do that and localization and of course other business consulting, guiding people, and the other leg is coaching and mentoring. And
You
I'm
also,
creating.
sorry, did I get this right? You're also a professor at La Salle Campus, Barcelona?
Yeah. I taught, I don't know if you know the CTS, Center of Translation Studies at University of Surrey. I was participating as a visiting lecturer to teach, to do localization strategy workshop, you know? So I teach that kind of thing, and I'm talking to other universities right now because CTS closed localization, business localization department. So it's orphaned workshop. I do it with Mihail Anchak. I don't know if you know Mihail. He's the localization technology director at PayPal. I work with him to do this kind of workshop, and we are planning to launch mentoring and coaching business together. We've been together for about 4 years now. So I work with him to create this business and the localization mentoring and coaching sessions and workshop. And La Salle is architecture and engineering higher education institute. It's like graduate school from University Ramon Lluch. I am in the digital transformation master courses, and they do usual master for young people. And we have also executive education and their MBAs,
MBA.
executive MBAs. So in this type of courses where executives comes in, I'm called to teach about global data, what's the state of digitization now, and how to navigate in this connected world, which is global, right? With language and culture and all that kind of stuff. So that's what I do at La Salle.
And let's unpack a little bit about the Global Chamber. What's the Global Chamber? Can you tell the audience what it is? And if anybody's interested in finding out more, how? Is there room for people to participate in it or not?
So Global Chamber is private enterprise. It's not official. We are headquartered in Phoenix, Arizona, and there's a school called Thunderbird Global Management at University of Arizona, State University of Arizona. This is a very famous graduate school for
Okay.
international business because they started to teach international trade and international businesses before Harvard and Stanford and all these business schools started to teach international. So it is highly ranked, a very famous international business school, and we have physical headquarters in this building, and the CEO is American. Right at this moment, I think we're going to move the headquarters from Arizona to California, but still not announced. But anyways, we operate by cities, and we call it metro, and we have 600 cities connected under the same brand, Global Chamber. And same rule of how to connect people, how to do event, and the same brand, Global Chamber. And I don't know exactly how many members we have worldwide, but it's a big, big organization. Let's put in this way. It's a chamber, but what we do really well is very human and very much more networking organization than doing a usual local Chamber of Commerce does. We connect people worldwide, wherever you
Wow,
are,
how do we connect
and
them?
we do. There are several ways. We have, of course, AI implemented. There's an AI called Globee, and you put yourself there, like information, and you put wish list. I would like to know these and these and these people, and I do this and that. So Globee, going through the data from everywhere in the world, it starts to connect you automatically, sending email. But the other way is very human. Usually, executive directors or chairman of the board members, they're connectors. So even if we have two or three people in one city, you can consider it's a deep organization as well, because we have our own network. So networkers and connectors are connected worldwide, and they know how to do. Executive directors and board members know how to do warm introduction, ask you, interview you, to whom would you like to meet? That's a question we always ask. For example, to whom would you like to meet?
Yes. For me, I would like to meet somebody who is interested in growing the revenue. I'm a fractional CRO. I do this, the podcasting as a side. Well, actually, it's parallel to the podcast. I do fractional CRO for companies who want to grow their business, who wants to set up sales structure, who are not sure about their current sales structure and need a second opinion. That's where I come. If you have a revenue problem, then you probably need to talk to somebody like me. And so
You
I don't know,
do.
like, how is, for instance, for a member listening to this and say, yeah, I love that idea. How is it funded? Like, how much does it cost to, what is it? How does it work?
So if you become a member of, for example, Global Chamber Toronto, which exists, to become a member, of course, we operate with membership, but it's a fraction of membership of other type of other networking organizations, like forgot the name, VStage. VStage, do you know VStage? Yeah, VStage is executive networking and mentoring, group mentoring organization, and we have a connection with them as well. But we are very, very different because we are networking organization, and so we charge fraction of VStage or other types of international business and networking organization. If you compare, it's unfair to charge the same amount of money depending on your revenue. Because if you're a revenue officer, you know that retail company has a huge revenue, but maybe profit margin is very, very small, right? And compared to the service industry, a consulting company with three people maybe have more profit than huge
Correct.
amount, right?
Services have a little bit more margin than retail.
So we have everybody from any industry, right? So the way we cut the category is the number of employees. From one to five, we only charge $500 for a year. So it's kind of, if you compare to the amount you need to pay LinkedIn, if you use it really, it's really nothing, right? So it's
And
very
people are
easy
finding
to.
results, Yuka. Are they
Oh yeah,
finding
of
good results?
course. Yes, of course.
What's the feedback from your memberships? I'm sure you do surveys for your membership. What's the
So
feedback from your membership?
I have a very good story to tell, maybe, because I told you anybody can join from any industry. And once there's a CEO introduced to me by one of my friends saying, "Hey, Jody need to export. Maybe you can help with Global Chamber." So I met Jordi from here in Catalonia, and he told me that his product is too innovative, and he knew that he could sell his product outside of Spain because Spain is a little behind in that regard. And he was coming from construction business. He was creating, his product was organic concrete. So I said to myself, and he said, there's traction from Iran, there's traction from England, there's some talk with north of Europe, and I know that there's market for me, right? So I said, and of course, let's do it. And he said, but I don't speak English. He spoke Catalan and Spanish, and I said, well, let's try. I'll help you. And I connected with, I mean, the headquarter people started to help Jordi as well. And he was invited to online networking events. And there are lots of online events, maybe 500 events a year. So you can pick and choose to go, and it's for free for members. So he was invited to some web-based networking event of Global Chamber to talk about his product and what he needs and blah blah blah, but in Spanish. There's some language-based meetup as well, Spanish, French, and all that kind of stuff. So he went to Spanish events, and I forgot about him there because I got busy and blah blah blah, and he was connected. He was active, very active in the Spanish community. So, okay, that's it. And 8 months in, suddenly I got a call from Jordi. Looking at my phone, my God, it's Jordi. I didn't do anything for him. Oh my God, oh my God. How am I going to tell him that I didn't get back to him either? Even I was calling him. But answering to the call, he said, my God, thank you very much, Yuka. I said to him, but what happened? What happened was one of the events he went in Spanish, many people got interested, and he talked and talked. And finally, that day, he signed a partnership agreement with a Colombian company, and he was export. I mean, his product is very complicated to ship. So he needs to do the knowledge transfer to
Being
produce.
produced on the other side.
Yeah, the other side, right? But he already signed that transfer and agreement partnership. So,
Success story.
I mean, you never know. You really never know. And it's not just me connecting members, and
Correct.
it's like a gym membership. If you get a membership for a gym
You got to go to the
and
gym.
go to the gym, but not sitting on the terrace, having beer, having coffee. Right, you need to
Right.
be doing.
I have to go to the gym. You just reminded me. I bought a membership last year. Maybe I went like a dozen of times. I haven't been to the gym forever.
Yeah, you need to use it. So the networking organization membership means you need to go to the event, present yourself, or and get connected, really.
Correct.
And you really never know where
Networking
you
is an
need.
art, and
Yes.
truly it's an art to network. And I do believe that this is a great topic of discussion for some, and I would love to dig deeper into it because
Oh,
most
yeah.
people think, they network happen naturally somehow by magic. It is not. It You actually have
No.
to put an effort in it, and you
Yeah.
actually have to know what you're doing a lot of times and sharpen it, get practice, practice it. Because people like they
Exactly.
think I show up and people are gonna buy from me automatically. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way because
No.
you may go in and do a pitch. It doesn't work. People don't like it. Don't get turned off because all you have to do is just go back in, see what did not work. Reshape the message, redesign the message. And, here's where people like in a network, physical networking event, like face to face in a networking event, sometimes people will ask you, so what do you do? And this is the typical question. What do you do? And you know how many times people like they scratch their head and they're looking around and by the time they tell me what they do, I'm lost. I don't know what they do. So I keep telling the people, like, you have 10, maybe 20 seconds, not even 5 seconds to attract people to you. So when you have that opening statement, when people say, what do? You better have that, I want to say tagline, whatever you want to call it, tagline, opening statements, first few words that comes out of your mouth, it has to be attractive for somebody to stick in, pay attention, and continue listening. Otherwise, they would listen, but they're not listening.
As I have so many things in my professional life, I can't really say in 10 seconds. So do you know what I do? I
What do
usually
you do?
do, if you ask me, what do you do? Well, I have lots of hats, so I usually tell you what you can be interested in. So Tell me about you. What do you do? Then I can respond. Or maybe I simplify if you ask me what you do. Well, can I ask first what do you do? Then I respond. This is the person I can talk about the global chamber. Oh, this is the person I can talk about localization. This
You
is,
gotta.
yeah. And it's the art of listening other than
Yeah,
speaking,
100%. This is very interesting conversation. Now, let me move on, if you don't mind, to where we are right now worldwide in the from a tech perspective, where we are right now. What's your vision for the future? You're known for expertise in innovation and technology. You know, you've done this many times. You've been at it for many years. In your world, where do you think this is going to go, and where we are right now? What do you see the future look like?
Well, I told you that at LaSalle I am participating in this digital transformation master courses. And last week I had a chance to be present at my colleague's presentation who does covers all these technology evolution. And what I believe is that nobody can stop what's happening.
The
And
genie's out of the bottle.
exactly. And if you watch what's happening, there are very good applications. For example, in Japan, why Toyota is so automated and why Japanese people are good at robotics? Because we don't have kids, we don't have workers. We can't expect to have more people doing things. That's the reason why we are very advanced with automation and robotics. So,
Need
robotics.
is the need is the mother of all
Yeah.
inventions.
So don't be afraid because there are very good applications and the technology is going to help us, So let's focus on that. And technology is like money. It's amplifier. Amplify,
Enabler, right?
yeah, amplify the people behind of the money or the technology. I mean, if evil people use the same technology, like
For evil reasons.
nuclear technology, there's a bomb to kill many people in a second. But if you use it for good applications, power plants, so that's exactly how technology works. And we need to reinforce to use technologies for good purposes. And I don't know if it's good or bad, but Europe is going for more regulations, more rules. And this is how I think we need to go. Of course, it's slower, but we can't really put dangerous tools like whoever wants to use can use type of situations. That's what I see. And what's happening is, again, I don't do good or bad, like
Yeah.
duality, polarity, duality, I don't do. So good situations, bad situations, it's your perspective. And I guess technology is good to help us advance. This is how humanity evolved, right?
Correct. It's the evolution of a humanity by using
Yeah.
tools, creating tools, and you go back to the Stone Ages. People used rocks to do whatever they need to do, and then they evolved from that. And we're with almost 8 billion people living in the planet. We require to do things a little differently to accommodate all humanity in a variety of needs, wants, desires, etc. You're seeing this in every aspect of our lives. We talk about it in the context with translation, but this is way beyond language communication. This is
Yes.
entering into every aspect of our lives, in any aspect of manufacturing, food processing, textile. It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. And it's making a difference, in my opinion, because I remember, during, you probably heard it, you lived in the US, during, the apartheid back in the 30s, etc. People were in the factories, doing minimal things to produce products. Well, if we maintain that same output, we wouldn't have, how would we be able to clothe, feed, provide healthcare for 8 billion people? We can't maintain the same level of throughput. We need a bigger throughput. Hence, mechanized way of doing things. Hence, you've got the assembly plants now to what do you call the to do the to assemble cars. That's the assembly plants created, I think, by people say it's Ford, but that's debatable. But the also created from that came in more automation, more mechanized way to accelerate the way we produce things. Now, when I look at the world today, and I don't know if you agree with this statement, I see it in two phases, in two sections. One, the section number one is the consumer will always have a choice to obtain services that they're automated or to buy product that is automated, similar to when you go to grocery shopping. You can buy a natural organic product, or you can buy the, bulk produced products. In any case, in any business, in any service, you will have two such choices. One is in a tra let's take the example of translation. You will need to, in some cases, you probably, as a consumer, I refuse to buy from a company that utilizes and buy and produces AI, a translation using AI or a various other technology. In some cases, you will have a buyer that says, listen, I would like to know the translator. I'd like to meet them. I want to have coffee with them. I want to shake hands with them. I'm using that as an extreme scenario to illustrate. But the point I was trying to make is two buyers. One is automated buyer that would like to buy from an automated machine, and the second buyer, an artisan buyer that would like to buy the old traditional fashioned way. I think
Coffee.
this is where we're at.
And I didn't tell you the other hat that I wear, which is the advisor for the Smart City, International Smart City Associations, because I did technology so much that I understand digital transformation, and these tools. I went into back to construction where I started after the university right now, and now I'm working with some cities to implement these digital tools as well. I touch digital twins of cities or buildings or all that kind of stuff. And if I tell you where we are, you're going to be surprised, because it's already like 3 or 4 years ago when I went to the Commission of International Promotion of Barcelona City. He told me that there's idea of having digital city already, and it can be two different things. One is like digital twin for operations for the people who work with the city's operations, traffic, mobility things,
Access.
security and access, all that kind of stuff. But the other is, he said, imagine there's a digital city like metaverse. You can go to the city hall of Barcelona from Japan, connecting and blah blah blah. So there's an idea of having this type of layer on top of the real city, and it's happening.
Yes,
And
and
the
I agree. I wasn't
language,
involved. Sorry, go ahead.
no, I think he didn't tell me about that, but I think language is a very important component of this type of digital layer, because if people from all over the world come to the digital city, somehow we need to make people interact either by written instructions or audio, right? But in their language. It's a very interesting point as humanity. This is all happening, So the language industry, I don't think it's gonna die. We really need to think big and their needs. If you go
Yes.
to, if I was in a logistics trade show this week, and I met some people who are dealing with logistics of products day in, day out, and
Okay.
their international movement as well. And of course, they need language. You can offer with, like you said, maybe machine, but there's some part that is needs to be done legally, right? So there needs to be a sworn translator, or maybe
Correct.
somebody who can have the stamp to do, so
Certified.
certified translation. So we just needs to move the real need of the clients or the world. And I don't think there's a world like, I heard something like localization is dead. I think it's completely reverse,
I think so.
because it's so connected. People don't realize that we need to communicate with other culture. We need to teach people at that level. Like, you can't really take no from Japanese people lately, or maybe they don't say no. How to communicate with other culture is totally different. It's a part of localization, right? So
Correct.
I think it's not that low at all. I mean, localization, as we know, like we did with the tools we had 10 years ago, maybe that process is dead, but it doesn't mean that localization itself.
We have to evolve to what's next, to evolve what else can we do to show value? And one of the biggest discussions taking place on this channel is to determine what is the value today, because yesterday had a different value than today. Past, 90, 1990, 90, 2000, 2010, localization had a different value to the customer. I'm talking about it's we can have an internal debate internally in the industry as much as we want, which is helpful, fine. But the segment that is more important in the conversation that needs to be cornerstone of every conversation is the customer we serve. Because we can design whatever services we want internally. If the customer at the end of the day say it doesn't work for me, or maybe it doesn't apply to my business, it doesn't make any sense what we do. It does not make a difference. It doesn't make a difference. And as you can see, the industry is more implicated by technologies from the outside than from the inside, meaning that most of the technology transformation that we've witnessed, with the exception of maybe less than a handful, are coming from outside the industry, not from inside the industry. That customers have forced us to go down the road of doing innovation that probably if we were left on our own, and I know some of our translators as much as you do as well, they would probably, some of the, not the new one that just graduated from college. That's not what I'm talking about. Fortunately, we still, we have technology, we have translators out there that would probably prefer to use typewriters. And if they were left on their own, they would probably use typewriters and word processing. But the world is moving around. We can translate. Who do we translate for? If we have no customer to buy our services, we can just translate it for the love of the translation. If
Oh,
you want to
yeah.
do that, go ahead.
Yeah. And I've heard, talking about technology, I've just heard something genius this week, because I'm not going to localization or translation events at all, because I have other types of events that I need to attend. And this week was logistics, and one of the presentation was genius. She said technology is the variable. Constant is processes and knowledge and talent. So that means that we can't get married to any technology, but we need to have a variety of technologies, and we need to make sure we know processes and knowledge how to do it and where's the goal, you know?
Absolutely.
So that's what I kind of think as of today, you know, and that's how we are going right now. And coming from the language industry, what shocked me last month, I went to a Industry 4.0 big trade show, which gathered like 30,000 people for 3 days. One of the panel said, okay, so we got this LLM thing, and we did blah, but in the factories it didn't work. So we are going back to the good old days, artificial intelligence, which means they're going back to machine learning, deep learning kind of AI with very intelligent automation. So people tested, did pilots, but in the actual cases, LLM is not working as we wanted in the real world. So that's what's
Yeah, it
happening.
depends on the use case and depends on the application, obviously. In some cases, depends on who did it and how they did it, etc. There is a gap that's been identified between the technology capabilities and the user's application. And that gap is expertise and knowledge and know-how on how to customize the technology to fit. In some cases, there is a lack of knowledge because I've seen it many times. People say, I tried AI, it doesn't work. Well, when you dig into the details, when you go through the details of why it didn't work, you would find in many cases, it's the, I don't want to call it lack of knowledge, but there's something missing and there is a gap between the engineers that they're putting these solutions together and the capabilities that they're. And I talk to these guys all the time on the podcast and outside the podcast. We run I run something called the networking event called the AI Exchange. It happens on Fridays every morning, where we bring all these use cases in and we debate them. We debate those AI use cases. And it's quite interesting to see how people are using these things. Why are they using it? In which context they are using these tools? Technology obviously is capable of many things, but how do we use it is up to us. And the biggest problem that I'm seeing right now is, and I'm not sure you agree with this, what people are doing is they're saying, okay, I've got a process that this process has been around for, let's say, 20 years or whatever. AI came in, so I put AI on top of the process. It's the wrong thing to do because then what you have is you have a brand new capabilities that you're trying to put on an old process. You may want to take a look at the process. See, do I redesign the process altogether? Do I need the so this is what's going to happen now is ability to figure out what process work, what process doesn't work, and can I use technology to help me figure out, is it a brand new process do I need? Do I need to remove steps from the process or perhaps create new steps into the process? But the riskier part is to overlay new technology on top of an old process. That's risky. I'm not saying it doesn't work, but I'm saying it's risky.
Risky, or maybe it's not most efficient way to apply a technology.
The reason I'm saying it's risky is because I'm using the word process in a global sense. There are some processes out there, a very small percentage of them. It may be okay for that. But the majority of the processes, you're going to say, it's going to break the system. I mean, you've stated a couple of examples, but I've seen it before. People rush in, they put AI because the boss told them to do that. And then it doesn't work anymore. Then you're already going back to square one. In some cases, people are laying off people. Because, oh, we've got AI in now. We don't need all these people. They haven't even realized the benefit of AI. They're just running off.
I mean, if you do that, how you maintain it, you know? So that's another question, because in the language industry, we have a dilemma of, you know, we can of course pass the source text to be translated with machine first, and then we can send the editing part to the skilled translators. But skilled translators are skilled translators because they did what they did before in the past, right?
They're going to be able to take
AI.
all their intellectual
Yeah,
property.
so how you
Oh, try.
train juniors to become the skilled translator, how do we do that without having this project to translate? I don't know. This is kind of a dilemma, and it's not just language industry, because somebody told me this week as well that in the logistic industry they are facing the same dilemma, because they can automate things, but at the end of the day the skilled expert needs to decide, because AI can suggest but never take decisions, and because the humans know when somebody is off. But I asked this speaker, so how do you train juniors to become this expert when you do everything automatic right now? And she was like, I don't know. I don't know the answer. Let's figure out.
This is the same question that academia is asking right now. Because if kids go to university, students go to university and study today, the old-fashioned way, you open your book, you read, you study, you write a test. I mean, I'm hearing it many times. Professors are finding out that their students are scoring 90%. 90% of the students are scoring a grade A on their test because they're using AI to do it. And now they have to put countermeasures in place to prevent it from happening. But okay, so you're doing the temporary thing. Okay, you're going to stop people from using AI now because you can. Devices are large, whatever you want to do, you can have counteracting technology to detect if this answer has been provided by AI or not. But down the road, and I'm working with a few cybersecurity companies in my job, and I'm feeling like down the road, you don't have a choice. The technology will overcome whatever barrier you are going to put in front of it. And so the bigger question becomes, us human, how do we learn and what do we learn? What do we learn? Kids going to university in the next 5 to 10 years. They're born now, 18 years from now, they're going to be going to college. What are we going to teach
So here's the question for you.
them?
What happened after the last industrial revolution
Revolution?
to the humanity? What happened? Now, I think human beings are more tends to become obese. Muscles are not so strong, and we are living more, but not necessarily healthy mentally or physically.
Part of the depopulation context, isn't it?
Yeah, so what's going to happen with AI if we translate what happened? It's not really bright. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I realize we're out of time and I'm having a conversation with you here, a casual conversation, but I do hear various theories. And one of the theses I've heard is 90% unemployment rate. It sounds extreme. It sounds far-fetched. We haven't hit singularity yet. I mean, singularity is coming. I mean, we're still in the AGI, and we haven't gotten to AGI completion yet. I'm thinking people are predicting various numbers, 2030, 2032. If we get to AGI and then ASI down the road, I mean, again, I'm asking the question because this is going to happen within the next 18 years. A kid is born now, a baby is born now. 18 years from now, assuming we're going to send them to college, if there are still colleges, what do we teach these kids? What does the education system look like 18 years from now, knowing that we're going to have singularity and we're going to have ASI by that time?
It's a very good question, but I would say we'll teach more literature, we'll teach more philosophy, we'll teach more dance, aim to become, creators of other kind of products, not
Correct.
products, art, and enjoy,
Correct.
right?
Anyway, I really enjoyed this conversation, Yuka. What do you think? Did you like it?
I did like it. Thank you very much for the invitation.
I really love the various topics that we've addressed today. I really enjoy them. When I publish all this, I'll let you know. I'll post them and I'll tag you with all my posts. It's been any other topic that you want to talk about that we have not yet
Yeah,
addressed?
we can do again. I have more topics maybe to
Yeah, I'd
discuss.
love to get you back, and whenever time allows, or whenever you have time, you're welcome back to the channel anytime you consider
Thank
it
you
your
very
home.
much. Truly enjoyed the conversation.
And next time I'm in Barcelona, I'll say hello to you.
Great.
I really love
Thank
it. For the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me and Yuka today in recording of this episode. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for listening in. If you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on our audio channels and listening into the conversation, thanks for listening in. I really appreciate your time with me. And also, if you're reading the blog where I summarize all these conversations and I archive them in a small consumable pieces of content, thanks for reading, thanks for sharing, etc. And the blog post site, for those who don't know, it's robinayoub.blog, where you can discover all the previous conversations that we've had. Similarly, you can do that on the L10N firesidechat.com. It gives you access to a variety of other pieces of content on the channel. Thanks so much for making us again the top five, one of the top five authentic conversation podcast globally. I really appreciate it, and I'm happy to announce that all the PR firms tell me this. I really appreciate you putting trust in this channel. Started this June. I'm celebrating our 3rd year, and I'm so excited about it. Thank you so much,
Thank
and I'll
you.
see you guys at the next episode. Thank you, Yuka. Thank you so much, and I'm going to stop recording right now, but we'll continue the conversation. There you go.